Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner, to my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofano, and we have a bunch of cases set for submission today. Two cases set for oral submission on the 1:30 docket and then some more at 3 o'clock. So I understand both sides are ready. Then we'll get started. Would you call the case, please?
Court will now call Texas Farmers Insurance Company and Farmers Insurance Exchange versus Frank Swarovski and Pamela Rush. May it please the court. Mr. Kent Chambers will argue for the appellant. Mr. Thomas Howard will argue for the appellate.
Okay. Kent, you ready?
This is an insurance coverage case, a liability coverage case, and the issue is, well, there's numerous issues, but one of the main issues is whether or not Texas policyholders, Texas insureds, can negotiate a settlement with their personal injury plaintiff opponent, including a family member who's suing the insured, and then hold their insurance company liable for the settlement that they negotiate with the personal injury plaintiff. That's what happened in this case. This is this case arises out of a riding lawnmower accident in which Pamela Rust sustained some bodily injuries, and she filed a lawsuit against Farmers for coverage for her medical bills. That was handled in a separate appeal. She also sued her father for negligence, and she was attempting to collect under his liability insurance policy on his home and an umbrella policy. And Farmers Insurance Exchange, the umbrella insurer, and Texas Farmers Insurance Company, the homeowner's policy for Mr. Karoski, which is Ms. Rust's father, filed a declaratory judgment action seeking a determination of whether or not his homeowner's policy and his umbrella would cover the lawnmower accident in which Ms. Russ had been injured. And this was filed here in Tarrant County in the 236 court. And within a couple of weeks, basically, Mr. Karoski entered into an agreed judgment with his daughter for $300,000 against himself. And during the summary judgment proceedings in the deck action, Mr. Karoski filed an affidavit that states, quote, "When Farmers filed this suit against me and my daughter seeking to avoid payment, I decided to negotiate my own deal with Pamela Rust and signed an agreed final judgment." That's in the clerk's record at page 299.
Okay, now can I interrupt a second?
Yes.
The agreed judgment was entered into in a separate suit, right? Not the declaratory judgment action, but Ms. Rust sued her father in a separate suit.
Right. In the underlying lawsuit filed by Ms. Rust against her father, which was in the 153rd, Mr. Karoski entered into a judgment against himself for $300,000.
The lawyer who was furnished by both insurers who was defending Mr. Karoski?
Yes.
Or by FIA, Farmers Insurance Exchange?
Well, technically, Texas Farmers Insurance Company is the one that actually paid the invoices to Mr. Thomas, but the reservation of rights letter that was sent to Mr. Karoski when he was sued was from Farmers Insurance Exchange, which was the umbrella policy, and from Texas Farmers. And that letter collectively said, "We are going to hire Jason Thomas to represent you and enter an appearance on your behalf, and we're reserving our rights." Now, Mr. Karoski says he didn't get that letter. It was mailed to the address shown on his policy, though. But Mr. Thomas did eventually sign on the agreed judgment as counsel for Mr. Karoski. They've recently, on appeal for the first time ever, now have asserted that, well, since Jason Thomas signed the judgment, then that means that Farmers agreed to it. But that is not the case. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever. First of all, that issue was brought up on appeal, never asserted in the trial court, that Mr. Thomas somehow represented Farmers. He He wasn't hired to represent farmers. I was. He was hired to represent Mr. Karosky, and as we all know, as lawyers, he owed a duty to his client, unilateral, solely to his client, not to farmers. And he could not bind, there's no evidence in the record that he somehow could bind Farmers Insurance to an agreement that Mr. Karosky stated that he decided to strike on his own. So the fact that he signed off on the judgment as counsel for Mr. Karosky just shows that there was Mr. Karosky individually and through his counsel agreed to the judgment, but not that farmers did. And this is not a new issue. I mean, this type of issue has come before Texas courts in the past, most notably in the Gandy case, in which the Texas Supreme Court struck down an agreement where the insured reached a deal with the personal injury plaintiff and then turned and in the same agreement assigned his rights to sue his insurance company. And the Texas Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You can't do this sweetheart deal where you're getting sued and you agree to a judgment against yourself and then make your insurance company pay it. So they struck that agreement down. Then in the Maldonado
case. Had the insurance company hired the lawyer in that case?
Yes. The insurance company, well, in the Gandy case, they entered into an agreed judgment. If I'm not mistaken, the insurance company had hired the attorney in that case as well, but I can certainly look that up. I don't recall factually whether they did, but
I believe that's correct.
I think they did, because the issue in that case, I believe, was they had made a Stowers demand or something like that, and it was rejected, and so they just went out and it entered into an agreed judgment against themselves.
Was it in the Gandy case, was the decision of the Supreme Court based on policy language or on public policy?
It was based on public policy, and they referenced, like, Mary Carter agreements that had been struck down because they distort the litigation process, and they said if the agreement meets these three criteria, then it's a void as against public policy. But really, we're not seeking to invalidate the agreement. We're simply saying Farmers isn't bound by the agreement. Farmers did not agree to it, didn't enter into it, didn't consent to it, and they're not bound to it without a trial.
Mr. Chambers.
Yes.
You did say that you recognize that John N. Thomas was hired to defend Mr. Frank Karosky, and that the cost of that defense was paid for, and I think you said it was by Farmers, not by Farmers Insurance Exchange.
If I'm not mistaken, and I believe it's in the record, that there's an affidavit from an individual named Tom Conrad, if I'm not mistaken, from Texas Farmers Insurance Company, that they had paid Mr. Thomas's bills from Texas Farmers Insurance Company, but collectively the two companies made the decision to refer them.
And the evidence in the case, I'm now talking about the evidence in the case in the 153rd court where the agreed judgment was entered.
Yes.
Does the evidence reflect that Mr. Thomas reported to any claims adjuster or other similar person at either Farmers Insurance Exchange or Farmers Insurance in the handling of that case for Mr. Karosky?
There's no evidence of any of that. There's no evidence in the 153rd. All there was pleadings and then an agreed judgment. There was no trial. There was no evidence.
In the 153rd. Okay. Well, is there evidence in the 236 of what kind of claims control procedure was followed in the case in the 153rd?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. This issue was raised for the first time in Appley's brief. We asserted that Mr. Karosky did not cooperate and that his lack of cooperation was a breach of the condition of the policy. They asserted that Farmers
waived it. I've read your briefs, and I understand. I don't know what you contend, but I'm trying to get to what's not shown in the briefs if I can. And I didn't see anything in the briefs about any handling of the 153rd lawsuit by any person who was directly employed by Farmers Insurance or Farmers Insurance Exchange. And if that's the case, then it's the first thing that I've ever seen in 42 years of law practice where the insurance company didn't have something to say about a claim where they were paying for the cost of defense.
Well, the evidence, the burden was on the appellee to first raise this issue as an issue in the trial court and then to present evidence of it. And there's zero evidence in the record about who Mr. Thomas reported to, what when he signed the judgment, was he intending to bind Farmers? Did he even have authority to bind Farmers? Was he simply signing the judgment because Mr. Karofsky asked him to? We don't know any of that.
Okay.
And the reason
I just want to be careful it wasn't in the record because if it was in the record, I wanted to see it.
Right. And the reason those facts weren't developed is because that issue was not raised until Appley's brief was filed.
All right. Thank you, sir, for answering my question.
And the Appley had the burden to show the way it works is we raised the defense of lack of cooperation, and he asserts, well, Farmers waived that. Or Farmers did agree, Farmers did consent to the judgment. And so if he was going to raise that issue, he should have first pled that issue, and then he should have had some proof of it, and he didn't. And so the court could remand the case to the trial court for that reason. But Farmers asserts that it shouldn't remand because the evidence did conclusively show that Mr. Karofsky didn't cooperate by his own admission when he says, I decided to negotiate my own deal because Farmers had filed this declaratory judgment action against me. That's proof right there that he wasn't cooperating with anybody, that nobody but him made that decision.
Well, more importantly, perhaps, I'm thinking, is the provision, the condition precedent that there had to be an actual trial for the homeowners company, or a trial, which the Supreme Court has held has to be an adversarial proceeding, followed by a judgment before the insurance company would be held liable. Isn't that
right.
Correct?
Unless the insurance company consents to it.
Right.
And that's basically...
That's where we are.
That's where we are. If Farmers had agreed to the judgment, if the parties had gone to mediation and there was a Farmers representative there or on the phone and they said, we'll pay you $300,000, then the case would have settled and none of us would be there. The fact that Farmers didn't agree to it is evidenced by the fact that, again, Mr. Karofsky said he struck his own deal. And secondly, Farmers was involved in litigation with Mr. Karofsky where Farmers was contending this deck action that there was no coverage. And further, the agreed judgment itself has, if you read the second page of it, says that Ms. Rust is required to try to seek to recover her judgment against Farmers first, and then if they can't, then she can attempt to collect from Mr. Karofsky. And it actually contains language in there that if Ms. Rust and Mr. Karofsky's insurance company reach an agreement, then Mr. Karofsky will be off the hook for the judgment. So it actually contemplates that Farmers was not a party to the agreement and contemplated that there might be future litigation or settlement or negotiations between Ms. Rust and Farmers to resolve the issue. So Farmers contends that the summary judgment record as it exists now is sufficient to reverse and render judgment in Farmers' favor on the basis that Farmers did assert and did conclusively prove that Mr. Karofsky didn't cooperate with Farmers to Farmers' prejudice in the form of an agreed judgment. And we've cited cases in our brief where insureds have reached agreements with their personal injury adversaries where a judgment results, and that is prejudice as a matter of law. But then there's a second basis, and that is the exclusion itself. Mr. Karofsky had numerous properties. He had a homeowner's policy, and he listed most of those properties on that policy, but he didn't list the next door house where his daughter lived, and she procured her own insurance. The reason she can't recover under that is she's the insured. You can't recover for your own injury under your own homeowner's policy. So they sought to establish liability on the part of Mr. Karofsky, and then, of course, coverage. And that's when we filed the deck action and said there's no coverage because it arises out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of property that you own, Mr. Karofsky, but you didn't list on your list of property under your homeowner's policy. And the umbrella contains an exclusion for injuries that arise out of the use of property the ownership, maintenance, or use of property that Mr. Karosky owns, and then it has an exception. However, this does not exclude coverage for real property damages so long as those damages are covered under your homeowner's policy. They had the burden to show that the exception applied. They did not do so. We proved that the accident did arise out of the use of the property. He was being sued for not fencing the property, for watering the lawn, making it slippery. So it was clearly a condition. It was a premises liability policy. A premises liability lawsuit. And the premises aren't covered if you don't list them on your policy. So we've got two bases for summary judgment, both of which we conclusively showed. He didn't cooperate. He prejudiced Farmers. And secondly, even if that hadn't happened, the accident itself wasn't covered because it arose out of the use, condition, or ownership of property that he did not insure under his homeowner's policy, and therefore it wasn't under the umbrella that they ultimately are attempting to recover under this case. And that's it in a nutshell, and I think I'm out of time. Thank you.
What name do you go by?
Your Honor?
What first name do you go by?
Tom.
Tom, okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Yeah, Tom Cowart. For Appley, Pamela Russ, along with co-counsel Scott Perry at council table. Your Honor, the way this case was shaped up was competing summary judgment motions. So the way I approached it in my brief was to just say the trial court correctly granted our summary judgment motion, and nothing that they raised in opposition to our summary judgment motion justified a denial or a reversal of that order at this point. And then the same reasons that stood for our motion being properly granted essentially defeated their motion for summary judgment. So I think that when you look at the record here that the our motion was properly granted. I mean, what our burden is an insured, because in this case here, Ms. Russ got a turnover order against Mr. Karosky, ordering him to turn over all of his claims and all of his rights against his insurance companies to her for her to prosecute. So as they concede in their brief, Ms. Russ steps into Mr. Karosky's shoes. So then the question becomes, on the judgment that she has against Mr. Karosky, is his insurance company liable to pay that under the indemnity provisions of the insurance policies that he held? And their brief was confusing to me because it kept kind of mining the homeowner's policies for arguments, but the homeowner's policies don't apply here. That was established in the 153rd litigation that went up to the El Paso Court of Appeals, and we didn't get a recovery on the homeowner's policies. The only thing that the court below ruled on was the umbrella policy. So anything that's got to do with the homeowner's policies, in our view, is half. It's something thrown up to try to cloud the picture a little bit here and see and distract us from the central issues, which have to do with the umbrella policy. So in our summary judgment motion, we showed that it was a claim for bodily injury caused by an accident brought anywhere in the world. And those were the elements that were required to be established under the umbrella policy for us to recover, for us to show coverage. And they defended by pointing to exclusions and other defensive terms in the policy. And we responded to that and responded again in our brief before y'all today on the theory that because they didn't properly reserve their rights with Mr. Karosky, they couldn't assert those rights here. They couldn't assert those rights at this time to defeat coverage on the defensive policies. And to me, that's really the central legal interesting question that's presented in this case, because the parties are looking at a 2008 Texas Supreme Court, the Ulico case, where the Supreme Court looked back at an old Court of Appeals case that had established what they called the Wilkinson exception, that says, make sure I've got it right, there, that if an insurer assumes the insured's defense without obtaining a reservation of rights or a non-waiver agreement and with knowledge of the facts indicating non-coverage, all policy defenses, including those of non-coverage, are waived, or the insurer may be stopped from raising them. So our argument was, like, for instance, here at the end of counsel's argument, he was talking about exclusion 28. And our argument was that you can't rely on exclusion 28. because you didn't properly reserve your rights to assert that now. And their response to that is, well, no, ULICO says you can't expand the coverage of the insurance policy by this waiver and estoppel. And our counterpoint to that, as far as the legal issue goes, is that ULICO doesn't go that far. What ULICO says is, we do not agree with Wilkinson's statement to the effect that non-coverage, in quotes, of a risk is the type of right an insurer can waive, and thereby affect coverage for a risk not contractually assumed. So if you go back and look at the underlying cases, and the parties have briefed these things in their brief, if you go back and look at the underlying cases, there's several that are thrown around by the Supreme Court there and several that are thrown around by the parties. But at the end of the day, the question is, what does the court mean by that? Because it doesn't say we overrule Wilkinson, and there's lots of cases out there citing this exception to say that insurance companies have got a burden to properly reserve their rights before they can go back and mine the policy for a bunch of defenses that they can throw up in the air to make their insurance go away, which is essentially what's happening in this case. They're going through and they're pulling all these terms and conditions and defenses and exclusions and anything they can find in there to throw at us to say, oh, you just have to go away. But the Texas law has said if you're going to do that, you've got to properly reserve your rights under a reservation of rights or a non-waiver.
Well, can I ask a question, please, about that? I think that, as I understand it, the sequence of events was the insurance companies reserved their rights. No, first, Ms. Russ sued her father. The insurance companies furnished a defense subject to a reservation of rights as to the coverage defenses and filed a deck action. And within two or three weeks of that, Mr. Kurowski entered into the agreed judgment with Ms. Rust. But how would the insurance companies have known that the agreed judgment without an actual trial was going to happen when it wrote its reservation of rights and filed its deck action? And does your argument extend to that issue of whether the insured could enter into an agreed judgment without the insurer's consent or permission?
I think it will. I think it does.
That's a long question. I apologize.
That's okay.
For that.
I apologize. just a couple of, you know, the one caveat I would throw in there is that the reservation of rights letter is in the record. They say we mailed it. Mr. Kurowski says I never got it. Mr. Kurowski, he doesn't say why. He just says they never. I didn't know that they had reserved their rights is essentially what he says in his affidavit. I never got that letter. So it's in there because they supplied it to us. It didn't come. I'm sorry. They filed it as part of the summary judgment proceeding. They didn't tell us about it. I'm sorry. We didn't. Strike all that. We didn't file it. We didn't have a copy of it. They filed it in the summary judgment proceeding. That's why it's in the record. Mr. Kurowski says, I didn't get it. So the question there becomes, is it an effective reservation of rights? And we come back to that. I think that what the case law says is that the insurance company can't lull the insured into believing that they've got a defense, and then midway through the litigation suddenly turn around and say, no, you don't. They've got coverage, and then midway through the litigation turn around and say, no, you don't. If you're going to say that there's an issue here about coverage, you have to tell the insured up front. That's the whole point of the reservation of rights at the very beginning of
the
policy.
But the agreed judgment hadn't happened yet
at the time
the reservation of rights was issued.
But the point there is that in order for them to assert that claim, that the agreed judgment falls outside of the coverage of the policy, they have to reserve that defensive provisions of the policy. And by not doing it properly, by not giving Mr. Kurowski a proper reservation of rights, not giving him the opportunity to say, look, if you all are going to defend me on the theory that eventually you might not pay any judgment that results, then I'll just go get my own lawyer. I don't want that kind of defense, which is what the insured has the right to do when they get a reservation of rights. That's the point of the reservation of rights letter, is that it gives the insured the opportunity to control his own defense. And so because the case law says you can't lull the insured into assuming that they're okay with their insurance company and then pull the rug out from anything. That's the teachings of the cases, I think, anyway, cited by the court in ULICO, the Craddock case, not Craddock, I'm sorry, the Murrah case and the McGuire case, that, you know, the insurance company, by giving reservation on the rights, puts the insured on notice that we're going to control your defense, but we're going to not pay for it at the end of the day. And if you look at Judge Jefferson's concurrence in ULICO, what he says there is that controlling the insured's defense, taking that away from the insured, is prejudice as a matter of law. That's and considered an important enough right that if the insurance company comes in and takes it away from the insured, that's sufficient to show prejudice. So,
well, how is the insurance company or either insurance company controlling the defense when their the deed counsel they furnished Mr. Kurowski entered into the agreed judgment without the insurance companies even knowing about it?
Well, I don't know that there's any evidence that the insurance companies didn't know about it. That's part of what Judge Meyer was getting at. There's no evidence either way in this record, whether or not the insurance companies, I agree with Mr. Chambers, there's nothing in here about what level of control the insurance companies exercised over Mr. Thomas, the defense attorney they provided to Mr. Kurowski. Our position, Your Honor, is that the reservation of rights letter says we're hiring Mr. Thomas to defend you. The insurance policy says if the claim is not covered by other insurance, we'll take over your defense. And in here, the claim was not covered by other insurance. So that's why I think, anyway, you've got both insurance companies on the reservation of rights letter saying we're hiring you an attorney. And Your Honor, as well, the evidence is that, and I marked it and left it on the table, but the affidavit that's in there says that the bills were actually paid by the other insurance company, not FIE. But that there is a testimony.
The affidavit of whom?
Mr. Tom Bryan.
Oh, Bryan. Yeah, I saw that.
Record
in the
164. That's where that
affidavit is. So the attorney was representing Mr. Kurowski.
He was,
solely.
Your Honor. But
solely.
Yes, ma'am. In terms of his attorney-client relationship, but that doesn't mean he's not also an agent of the insurance company. I mean, the cases that the insurance company cites are all vicarious liability cases, and there's a distinction in my mind in between saying you can be held liable for somebody's malpractice.
That's a Traver case.
Yes, ma'am. And on the other hand, saying that means they're not your agent. I mean, and the Ranger case, which, you know, it's not the most popular case in the world, I admit, but what it does say in there is that the insurance companies hire attorneys, and those attorneys then become sub-agents of the insured. Well, if they're a sub-agent of the insured, they're an agent of the insurance company. I mean, they have to be somebody's agent to be a sub-agent. So, I mean, the import of Ranger is that the insurance defense lawyers that are hired by the insurance companies are the insurance company's agents. They are provided by the insurance company on a contractual basis. That's true, and the insurance company is not responsible for their legal malpractice because of the nature of the independent contractor relationship. I mean, that's just standard independent contractor law that I can be sued for hiring an incompetent or I think it's grossly incompetent independent contractor, but I'm not going to get sued for their, you know, her direct acts of negligence because that's why I hire an independent contractor. But that doesn't mean that independent contractor doesn't have the authority to bind me or to do things, and I don't have the right to instruct them about things that I want done. What it means is that I can't go in there and say, you know, in theory anyway, I suspect that in the insurance defense world and the relationship in between insurance companies and insurance defense attorneys that are routine insurance defense lawyers, there's a lot more control in there than they want to admit, is what I suspect. I've never been on their side of the docket and had to deal with that kind of
insurance. You're talking outside the record now.
I am, Your Honor. You're absolutely right.
And I understand I went outside the record by what I said, but I wasn't inviting you to go outside the record.
I apologize. But the point being, Your Honor, that the evidence in the record is that they hired this lawyer. They supplied it to him. The law is that he's an agent of the insurance company, I believe. He might not be their lawyer, but he's their agent. And they're held responsible for what their agents do.
Let me direct you,
you
just
a case
moment, please. Away. I want to invite you. I'm sorry, Judge.
You're not,
you
Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Judge.
Let's focus just a moment on the reservation of rights letter.
Yes, sir.
What is it about the letter? I understand your contention is it was never delivered, and therefore there might be an issue about that. But what else about the reservation of rights letter was defective?
In terms of what it said, in my view, Your Honor, it's a fine reservation of rights letter.
Okay.
It doesn't. The problem is that the case law says they have to effectively reserve their rights, and that means you got to deliver the crazy thing. I mean, they've got an obligation to make sure that their insured knows that they're defending under a reservation of rights. They can't just go to a well and yell it down to an empty well saying we're reserving our rights. That's not effective.
Was there any development or any discussion about there being a fact issue in your summary judgment motion? In other words, you were granted summary judgment. Was there any discussion on the part of the insurance companies that you had failed to totally negative any question about delivery?
In other words, did they contest that the Preservation of Lights rights letter was not delivered?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
And why isn't that a fact question about the effectiveness of the Reservation of Rights letter in the summary judgment?
Because it's their duty. It doesn't go against us. We moved for summary judgment. We showed what we had to show under the insurance company: bodily injury caused by an accident somewhere in the world. That's our burden. And the insurance two-step is we've got to show coverage, then they come in and show all the other stuff.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
So going back to Ulico, Your Honor, the important thing here that I did want to be able to say in my last 30 seconds here, Craddock is the case of the defendant's site that's discussed in Ulico. Craddock is not an assumption of the defense case. It's I got hurt, shot myself in the leg, pay me money. Insurance company 11 weeks later says, oh, wait a minute, you shoot yourself, that's not a covered claim. So it's not an assumption of the defense case. You can leave that one aside. McGuire, if you'll look at the underlying opinion, it's not set out in the Supreme Court's opinion, but in the underlying McGuire opinion, the problem is that using somebody else's car is not an automobile by definition under the insurance policy. So it's a definitional issue. They don't cover you. In that case there, he's driving his employer's truck when he gets in a wreck. He files a claim on his personal liability policy. And the underlying opinion says, by definition, it's quoted out of a pleading, admittedly, but it says that somebody else's vehicle is not defined as a covered auto under the policy, which means there's no coverage. It's not an exclusion or anything else, a defensive issue. It's a no coverage issue. Again, you can't change the policy to say, even though the policy says we don't cover other people's cars, because you waive that by not asserting it. Well, no, because that's my burden. My burden is to show that I fall into the definition. Murray is the same way, and I'm out of time, Your Honors.
I'd like for you to address Gandy. With respect to the validity of an agreed judgment without trial or consent.
Right. Gandy.
In which I believe there was defense furnished.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'd have to go back again, like he says, and look and make sure. I thought Gandy was that one where there was a very complicated sex abuse underlying facts, and there was lawyers that were and were not involved with the insurance company. So I might getting confused with another case, but Gandy says there's three things that you've got to be able to show to prove that it's triggered. The adjudication or the agreement has to come before an adjudication. It has to be a settlement agreement. It has to come before the adjudication of the claims. The insurer has to assume the defense, and the insurer has to either tendered. Oh, doggone it all, Your Honors.
Anyway,
at the end of the day on this thing, they don't have all that.
Calm down, take a deep breath. You got all the time you need.
Once the light goes red, I start panicking.
Don't panic, because we...
Lights off.
You gave it to me.
Yeah.
So I've got myself all flustered now. I apologize. We've got a turnover order. That's how we got this. This isn't directly a settlement agreement where he has assigned, because in Gandy it's an assignment of the claims against the insurance company that they're challenging. This isn't an assignment. This is a turnover order, which we think is a distinction, because that means that he's been compelled to do something. It's not a matter of him agreeing to it. He's been compelled to do it. The other part, Gandy says, they have to either have reserved their rights or made a good faith effort to adjudicate the coverage issue prior to the settlement being entered. Now, they didn't reserve the rights. And he settled this. Yes, admittedly, the settlement agreement is signed on February 19th. They managed to get their lawsuit filed on January 29th. So,
their declaration of?
The deck action, yes, ma'am, in the 236.
To determine coverage.
2 or 3 weeks before it's actually signed. Now, it's not signed by Mr. Karofsky. It's signed solely by Mr. Thomas on Mr. Karofsky's behalf. So.
Wait, now, you're talking about the agreed judgment?
Yes, sir.
Isn't that Mr. Karofsky's signature on? Page 156 of the record that's attached to.
You see, Judge, I thought, no. The agreed judgment's at 225. Oh, it is. I'm sorry. No, wait. You're right, Judge. I got myself confused on that.
Not a problem.
I'm just
trying to be careful. But I'm reading.
You're absolutely correct, and I'm absolutely wrong, Your Honor. So they were rocking along providing him with the defense. And, you know, is that a good faith effort to adjudicate coverage when you don't provide a reservation of rights letter, you provide him with a defense attorney, the defense attorney's involved in the litigation, and you prolong doing anything until right on the eve of them signing it. I don't think so. I mean, so my position on Gandy is that the three elements that it requires, we miss on two, or they miss on two of them, Judge. And in addition, I think that you got to get through the waiver and estoppel issues first, which we were just going through. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think that the judgment should be affirmed. And that's what we ask y'all to do.
Any questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thanks. And if you need more time, you'll get it.
Okay. First of all, Gandy, to answer the Justice Garner's question earlier, one of the elements for invalidating this type of arrangement is that the insured was being defended. I mean, that was kind of the whole point. How can the insured go out and reach a deal, a sweetheart deal with his opponent, and make his insurance company fund it when the insurance company's defending him? So yes, one of the very elements is the insured was being defended by the insurance company when he entered into the agreement. So the fact that Mr. Thomas was hired by Farmers to represent Mr. Karosky, who then entered into a unilateral settlement agreement with Ms. Rust, his daughter, does not mean that Farmers is somehow bound simply because the attorney was signed on the judgment along with his client. And it says under his signature, attorney for defendant Frank Karosky, not for Farmers. All three elements of Gandy are met. The assignment occurred without an adversarial trial. That's element one. The insured was being defended. That's element two. And thirdly, the insurer had made a good faith effort to adjudicate coverage. Farmers had filed a declaratory judgment action. Now, to put the things in sequence, the first lawsuit was originally filed as a medical payments claim under the policy by Ms. Rust against her own insurance company on her house, Farmers. And Farmers denied the claim because it doesn't cover injury to the insured. She amended and asserted that Karosky was negligent. So that was all in one lawsuit in the 153rd. Farmers filed a summary judgment in that case saying your medical payments claim is not covered. That was ruled on in Farmers' favor. It was appealed by Ms. Rust. It was transferred to the 8th Court of Appeals, and they decided that issue. They decided your medical payments claim is not covered under your policy. And they reserved all these other issues about liability coverage because Mr. Karosky had not yet been held liable. While all that was going on, our declaratory judgment case was abated. When the 8th Court of Appeals issued their opinion and everything was final, our case came out of abatement and our summary judgment went forward. The basis for the reservation of rights letter originally was simply exclusion 28 for as far as Farmers Insurance Exchange was concerned. As far as Texas Farmers was concerned, there were some other exclusions that are set forth in our brief. And the reason I brought all of that into the brief is because Texas Farmers was a plaintiff in the declaratory judgment action. Nobody ever filed a summary judgment against Texas Farmers. Texas Farmers was asking for a declaration that it did no coverage, and yet its rights were summarily adjudicated against it without a motion. That's error. And so that was briefed along with the crux of the case, which is the umbrella policy, simply to give the background to the court, but also because Texas Farmers is entitled to a summary judgment in its favor, a declaratory judgment in its favor, that its policy doesn't cover this loss. So the reservation of rights letter was about exclusions. This accident isn't covered under your policies. That letter was mailed to the I've included the homeowner's policy under tab D and the umbrella policy under tab E. These are the policies that were in effect at the time. There's some other policies, some prior policy in there. But the policies that were in effect at the time show Frank Karosky, 4325 Fossil Drive, Fort Worth, Texas. The umbrella policy, same address, 4325 Fossil Drive, Fort Worth, Texas. This is tabs E and F. That's the address on the letter, on the reservation of rights letter. What is defective about sending a reservation of rights letter to the insured at his address that's shown in the insurance contract? They have yet to explain how that is defective. How is that any evidence of an intentional relinquishment of rights? How is that any evidence of conduct inconsistent with asserting your rights under the policy that it's not covered because of exclusion 28? They've never explained that. I guess their position is, in order for insurers to properly reserve their rights, they can't mail the letter to the address shown in the policy that the policy, you know, covers that house at that address. They have to mail the letter to some other address.
Well, you have some return receipt or something in the record that shows that it was actually mailed.
An affidavit by Tony Johnson.
Just an affidavit.
The adjuster handling the claim says, I mailed this letter on November 25th, 2009, or whatever year it was.
But it wasn't sent certified, so there's nothing to show it was actually delivered. Okay.
And their reason for it not being delivered is that the address should say Haltom City, not Fort Worth. So that's no evidence that it wasn't mailed.
Is there evidence that it was not received?
He signed an affidavit saying I didn't receive it because it was mailed to Fort Worth, not Haltom City. But there's no evidence it wasn't mailed. The only evidence is that it was mailed to the address shown in the policy.
Oh, wait. Okay, under tab D, Farmer's Declaration page, Frank Kurowski, 4325 Fossil Drive, Haltom City, Texas.
Right. That's the predecessor policy. That was included because the umbrella policy references a policy number. On the umbrella policy, he has a list of underlying insurance. And when the umbrella policy was issued, this was the policy number. That policy was replaced, and it's in tab E, on September 11, 2007. So about 3 weeks into the policy, it was rewritten under Texas Farmers.
Okay. And then, so under tab E, you have the same address with the same zip code, but Fort Worth, which may or may not be an impossible address. I don't know. Depending on whether the Haltom City address was correct. Then under tab F, you have the umbrella policy, and it has Fort Worth 76117, same zip as the Haltom City. And then under tab G, you're back to Haltom City address with the same zip code.
So you know, there's no evidence in the record from the post office on which one.
So which address did y'all send it to, Fort Worth or Haltom City?
Fort Worth, which is the address shown in the umbrella policy. They've said that the homeowner's policy isn't even relevant. The address shown in the umbrella policy says Fort Worth. This is word for word the address. The letter was mailed to Frank Kurowski, 4325 Fossil, Fort Worth, Texas. Tab G is the homeowner's policy for Miss Rust on her household that she was renting.
Is there any evidence whether the letter was returned to you?
It wasn't sent. No. No, Your Honor.
Or not returned only that, to the adjuster who mailed it to the wrong address?
Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record one way or the other in that. There's an affidavit from the adjuster saying, I mailed it to this address, which is the address shown in the policy, Fort Worth.
Well,
then there's
do
evidence.
You not, I mean, is there, do y'all have anything that shows where things are located, like where this address, I mean, if you're insuring the property at this address, do you have a map or anything that shows where this address is located?
No, Your Honor, and we're not required to do that. The policy was issued to him at this address. He goes to his agent and he procures a policy, and this is the address shown in the policy. And that policy would have been mailed to that address. And all the mail under that contract would go to that address in that policy. And he was mailed a letter, a reservation of rights letter, to that address. Now, he says he didn't get it, but that's not evidence it wasn't mailed. But all of this whole issue is only relevant on the on Mr. Karofsky's and therefore Ms. Rust's affirmative defense of waiver and estoppel. That's the only way that this becomes relevant. We said it's not covered because of exclusion 28. He says it is covered. We went to court and we filed a deck action. Judge, decide this coverage issue. And because we brought a legitimately disputed coverage issue to the court and filed it, he says, well, I decided to strike my own deal and then make the insurance company pay for it. And now they're and we then asserted, well, you haven't cooperated and you haven't complied with the policy condition that requires a trial. And that's when he said, well, you waived that because you didn't send me a reservation of rights letter. Mm-hmm. And we said we did, and we provided evidence of it. They had the burden not only to prove non-receipt of a reservation of rights letter, but to prove all of the, at least come forward with some evidence as a non-movement on our summary judgment, come forward with some evidence of each element of waiver, of each element of estoppel. They haven't done that. And as movement, they had to conclusively prove waiver and estoppel.
All right. We've done this before. So is there anything else you need to bring up?
Just on this issue about Mr. Thomas being supposedly the sub-agent, I wanted to reply to that just real briefly. The case law that he cited, the Ranger versus Gwynn case, actually says the attorney, I'm quoting here, the attorney becomes the sub-agent of the insured, not the insurer. And then if you read the following sentence, it says, when Ranger undertook to defend Peden and Gwynn, it singular, meaning Ranger, became their, Peden and Gwynn's, agent. Ranger hired attorney Otto Ritter to represent Peden and Gwynn, so Mr. Ritter became their, plural, sub-agent. So he's the insured's sub-agent, not the insurer's.
Okay.
And so I just wanted to respond to that. That's in our reply brief.
Can I ask one last question, counsel? I know. Are you through?
No, I was asking if there are any more questions.
I'll have one more.
Sure.
And I'm sorry to prolong your presentation
okay.
to us, Mr. Chambers. I asked counsel about the fact issue being raised in the summary judgment, in the 236, in the summary judgment that was granted on behalf of the plaintiffs. And I'm interested in your response to, is it your position that a fact question was raised about the issue of delivery in the summary judgment proceeding in the 236 court wherein the judgment was granted?
No, because the fact issue is only relevant if it is a genuine issue of material fact. Whether he received it or not is not a material fact, and whether or not he mailed it is not a material fact, because that issue of the reservation of rights is one of several elements of their defense of waiver and estoppel, and they haven't produced any evidence of any of the other elements.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Wow, we appreciate your argument. As you can tell, we did have lots of questions. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business or just stay and listen to the next case if you'd prefer.